Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And I'm going to talk a little bit about today about the Liberal Party in Great Britain and the First World War. And there is a Liberal government up to 1915, and then due to a series of crises, that Liberal government is replaced by a Liberal-led coalition. It involves the includes the Unionists, or Conservatives as they are known now. But before we get into that, it's important to have a little bit of backstory on the Liberal Party. Some of you might be studying this, a great many of you will probably know this, but let's talk about it anyway. The Liberal Party came to power in 1906 on a landslide victory, promising social reform, and between 1906 and 1911, they fight a series of titanic battles with the House of Lords, and particularly the Conservative peers in the House of Lords, over Lloyd George's People's Budget. The basic premise of the People's Budget was that social reform and military expenditure, Britain is undergoing an arms race with Germany over the issue of dreadnoughts. The two things cannot be afforded through the standard means of taxation, and therefore there must be taxes upon wealth, particularly on land. And there is a hue and cry that Lloyd George is a socialist, that the country is becoming less democratic. And Lloyd George goes on an epic tour of working class audiences across the country, saying, "You know, who is running this country? The government or the Lords? They must pay. You know, a duke must get in his hand in his pocket to pay for dreadnoughts and to pay for things like old age pensions and sickness insurance and those kinds of things that were being offered under the Liberal reforms." That doesn't spare the Liberals from three crises. Now, there's a very famous book, of which I'm sure probably a whole bunch of you are aware, George Dangerfield's The Strange Death of Liberal England. And he puts forward a thesis that before the war, three crises are mounting. There is a potential civil war brewing over the issue of home rule in Ireland. And this is something, this civil war issue is something reading Christopher Clark's Sleepwalkers that much of the rest of Europe seemed acutely aware of and seemed to almost be predicting. So there's a possibility of a home rule between a civil war over the issue of home rule between Catholics and Protestants in Ireland. Then there is militant syndicalist unionism and the spectre of possibly a general strike emerging. The legalisation of unions in 1871, and then the Trades Disputes Act of 1906, which gave unions basic immunity from litigation if their strike action caused employers to lose profits, following the Taff Vale case, which had made the railway unions liable for any loss of profits that the rail companies experienced. And during this period, as a result of the Taff Vale case, obviously the Labour Party emerges as well. So the Liberals find that they have a new contender for the crown of socially reforming party. The third crisis, perhaps of slightly less seriousness, but a one that is starting to become violent, is the issue of female suffrage. The National Union of Women's Suffrage Societies and the Women's Social and Political Union have spent the best part of the previous decade, and in the NUWSS's case, the two decades beforehand, campaigning for suffrage. And the radicalisation of the movement is seen hunger strikes, the Cat and Mouse Act, and smashed windows, and Lloyd George's own house being burnt down by suffragists. These three crises, Dangerfield argues, are put on hold by the war. The war comes along, and the instincts of trade unionists, of Ulster unionists, and indeed Catholic nationalists, and the suffragist movement is to reluctantly rally behind the Liberal government, give it the support that, if not the love, and then to hopefully gain something from the peace once, you know, hopefully, obviously, Britain is victorious. The motivations of all these parties are slightly more complex, and I won't dwell on those, because I want to just give you that little bit as some kind of context. Because the Liberal government, assuming the Liberal government has been given this stay of execution, it squanders it appallingly in the first 2 years of war. Now, to some extent, this is understandable. We are facing a war that is unprecedented in human history. There has been nothing of this magnitude ever before. And it shows the strains show on the Liberal government and the Liberal government's relationship, particularly with the army. The issue of war supply is the first key area that causes crisis for the Liberal government. The ministry responsible for supply is the War Office. The War Office is under the leadership of Herbert Horatio Kitchener. And Kitchener's an interesting character in the first week or two of the war, because he's the first figure really to stand up and say this is not going to be a short war. This is going to be a long, drawn-out conflict, and it's going to be the likes of which we've never seen before. It's going to be a war of attrition, and it's going to take years to win. It's going to take millions of men. But having made these kinds of statements, the War Office, who is that he presides over, does very little to actually equip the new armies that Kitchener proposes. Kitchener does an excellent job of raising huge new armies, and the British Expeditionary Forces sent to France is a tiny 10-division army, six infantry, four cavalry, and it is a kind of a gnat compared to the might of the French army and the German army. But it is professional, and it's non-conscript, so it performs, punches above its weight considerably. The British are traditionally the nation that puts most of their efforts and energies into naval power. Naval power is where Britain has its advantage. Britain in the First World War and in the Second World War, there are significant voices, normally people like Churchill, that in both wars, that argue fight a war at the periphery, fight in places like Gallipoli, fight in places like North Africa in the Second World War. Don't engage the enemy head-on because you haven't got enough manpower. Use the navy effectively and fight from the sea, fight with amphibious landings. And then whilst you're doing that, whilst you're cutting off the enemy's supply lines and slowly choking them, form coalitions with a major continental power like France or a major continental power like Russia. They can do the heavy lifting and you can support them to some extent on land. Now, the Kitchener thesis flies in the face of all of this, and the great model for this war at the periphery idea is obviously the Napoleonic Wars. But Kitchener raises new armies, and he raises particularly Powell's battalions, normally from northern towns, where the young men are told that if they want to, they can join up and fight as Powell's battalions, where they will all train and fight together, so they'll have people they know. Sadly, the effect of the Powell's battalions on local communities was devastating, because once one Powell's battalion was wiped out at the Somme or Ypres, the entire community would lose every eligible young man that lived, by and large. So there was a devastating effect, and they were, it's quite poignant in many ways. You see photographs of Powell's battalions raised from rugby clubs, cricket clubs, football clubs, universities, this kind of thing. All these young men in 1914 together, ready to go off and, you know, never coming home. So there is a huge amount of bureaucratic chaos within the War Ministry, and the War Ministry are stuck really with ideas about shell supply. The supply of shells isn't really enough to last till Christmas, and the even when after the War Ministry's supplies gets moved over, the supply role gets moved over to Lloyd George's new munitions ministry, which is established the following year, the munitions ministry still doesn't manage to bring the level of shells and artillery needed up to full levels, up to the levels that the army actually want, until 1918. That's how bad shortages were throughout the entire war. The British Army goes to war with just over 1,000 machine guns. Field Marshal Haig thought 2 were needed per battalion, whereas Lord Kitchener thought maybe 4. And I think Lloyd George said something pithy, as he was tended to do, something to the effect of, you know, take what Haig says and double it, square it, times it by 10, and then double it again, and that's the figure you need. So by the end of the war, there are about 250,000 machine guns with...
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
The British Army. The idea of tanks, which really are something pioneered long after the kind of the trench deadlock has begun, and really as a result of the deadlock, again, the War Ministry sniffs at and thinks they're kind of silly contraptions, and that there's nothing like a good old cavalry charge, really. So there were men who were really thinking that thinking about fighting the last war. Now, one of the reasons for the shell crisis is because the way that artillery usage was envisaged at the start of the war was that the artillery would fire periodically, and they would support the movement of men. You'd have armies moving across the battlefield and armies advancing strategically backward and forth, or hopefully not backward, but anyway, forth, to engage one another. And the artillery would be used from time to time in order to support this. However, when the artillery become fixed pieces behind the trenches and we're in a situation of trench warfare, and the only way really to attack the enemy, other than going over the top, is to use constant artillery, then the cannon goes from being a periphery piece of equipment to being the central means of attack. And the British Army becomes artillery-based as a result of the First World War. In fact, it causes, I think, more casualties than any other weaponry that the British have. The problem, of course, is how to supply this vast new demand for artillery. And by 1915, there are clear reports in the Times and in the Daily Mail, both Northcliffe papers, that there is a huge shortage of shells. And the Field Marshal Sir John French is the person who is leaking all this back to London. The King, King George V, was partially involved in this chicanery. King George V saw himself really as the patron of the army. The army officers believed themselves to be the king's men, not really the prime minister's men. And they served under the prime minister. They served British prime ministers under sufferance. King George was a figure who was there to be consulted, to advise and to warn, as is protocol for modern British monarchs. But he viewed the appointment of army officers really as something that he could have an input in. And he spoke up vociferously on behalf of people like French, but he's actually part of the team that sacks French in the end. And he is also somebody who helps to channel the grievances of generals in the right direction. Asquith, throughout this period of time, is a surprisingly laissez-faire prime minister. The war is being run, really, by Kitchener and Churchill, to a lesser extent until he becomes Minister of Munitions, Lloyd George. Lloyd George at this point is the Chancellor. And a little bit by Kitchener and Lloyd, well, the thorn in both Kitchener and Lloyd George's side, Jackie Fisher, who until 1915 held the office of First Sea Lord. So this little triumvirate are partly responsible for Gallipoli. There is a need, once the Western Front has ground to a halt and trench warfare is the mode of fighting, it's seen that there is a need to break deadlock, and the Dardanelles campaign is dreamt up in order to knock Turkey out of the First World War and really create what Churchill believes will be a soft underbelly approach into Europe. And there are moments where it looks like it's going to succeed. Hindenburg, in his diaries, believes that had the British been able to land at Alexandretta, then Turkey would have been knocked out of the war and Germany would have been terrifyingly surrounded. If British and Russian armies had been able to meet up, that possibly would have been the end for the German-Austrian axis. But mercifully, a dispute with the French prevents this from occurring. The Dardanelles campaign, you know, I don't want to go into that too far because it's a topic of a separate podcast, I think, really. But the Dardanelles campaign ends in disaster. It ends in Churchill being forced to resign in disgrace and go and do a stint with the Black Watch on the Western Front. It ends in Fisher leaving the Admiralty he had huge misgivings about the campaign to start with and thought it wasn't going to work, but he resigns in disgust. and leaves Kitchener hugely marginalised. And the problem as well is you have this mounting scandal over the shells issue, the ammunition crisis. And Kitchener goes from being this quite visionary figure, this impressive former Imperial War hero, the man who called the war just right in 1914 and knew exactly what was going on, to being an increasingly irrelevant and rather embarrassing figure who is not seen as being a safe pair of hands. Asquith is quite happy to channel all the bad news towards these three figures anyway. It suits him fine. And he doesn't realise that at a certain point in the future he's going to make a catastrophic blunder. The blunder that he makes is by giving Lloyd George command of the new Ministry of Munitions. He knows Lloyd George is a spectacularly effective, talented, skilled man who understands organisation, he understands business, and he knows how to deal with the unions as well. And he knows how to keep them, the trade unions, sweet so that there isn't any outbreak of industrial unrest. I mean, there is considerable industrial unrest, but there's not sufficient sort of industrial unrest as that as may threaten a major strike or perhaps even, God forbid, a general strike. Lloyd George knows how to compromise, conciliate. And Lloyd George creates through the Defence of the Realm Act, he manages to control large swathes of British industry, the British defence industry, and he's able to requisition at cost, and so he pays good money for it, all the resources he needs to build a new munitions industry. He himself, the ministry itself, builds 281 factories. It has 50,000 staff by 1918 and commands 3 million workers. So this is the kind of the scale of the operation that wins the war. And it's very much, the First World War, it's very much a war based on logistics and economics. And that's how it's won. The Germans are only really defeated on the battlefield in 1918. They are triumphant in most theatres between now and then, between 1914 and 1918. But that kind of doesn't matter, unfortunately. This is the banal logic of war, that militarists within the German army never quite fully grasp. You know, heroic bravery has got nothing on the ability to mass produce arms. So Lloyd George manages to come to a compromise with the trade unions, which enables them to accept unskilled workers into the workplace who will then replace men who've gone off to fight on the front on the understanding that these jobs will go back to returning veterans at the end of the war, and there'll be a general agreement to try to limit strikes. And Lloyd George comes out of this looking great. He comes out of this as a man with a common touch against the increasingly distant Asquith. So when it finally comes in 1916 over the issue of conscription for Lloyd George to replace Asquith as the head of the coalition, he manages to do so with aplomb, and he uses everything he's all the credit he's built up as the man who is organising to win the war up until that point. The creation of the coalition by Asquith is really an attempt to shore up a flagging Liberal government. The unionists are invited in 1915 to join a government, and both Arthur Balfour and Andrew Bonar Law are given ministerial positions. But Asquith keeps the top jobs in Liberal hands: Prime Minister, Foreign Secretary, Chancellor, anything worth having, really. Bonar Law, not really befitting his status as leader of the opposition, is given the Colonial Office, which is seen by many as being something of a backwater. So they call it a coalition, but it's not really. It's not really a fair partnership between the two parties. It is Asquith making sure that he wins the game, if only for a year, because in 1916 he's replaced by Lloyd George, who then goes on for the second half of the war to be accredited in the public eye, at least, as the man who wins the war. Anyway, I hope you found that useful and interesting, and I'm going to catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. We've got some cool stuff coming up. In the next couple of weeks, I'll be publishing a new student guide on international relations, 1870 to 1914. So if you're studying that, keep your eyes peeled. And in the next month or two, I should have the long-awaited Chiang Mao and the Battle for China, which I'm kind of enjoying writing at the moment. And there's a whole bunch of stuff to review, some great titles out there. And I'll be doing a China podcast special on a glut of China books I'm reading at the moment in early February. I may take a week off or so. My wife and I are expecting a baby, and so if you don't hear from me for, you know, a week to 10 days, or there's a kind of high-pitched noise in the background, well, guess what? Parenthood comes to us all. Anyway, look forward to catching you on our next podcast. Remember to subscribe, and I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.